This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, one of the hosts of NPR's Planet Money podcast. I'm sitting in for Al Letson, who's working on a new serial from Reveal that you're going to be hearing a lot more about in the weeks ahead. So I live in Los Angeles, and one thing about LA is that even though altogether it is huge, it's really just a bunch of little neighborhoods.
I mean, I like everything about all around here because I'm from here. It's where I grew up at.
Andrea Bryant is from South LA.
I had the two combos and the 123 shrimp with the large.
She's picking up takeout from John's Fish Market there. It's one of her favorite spots.
This is the only place I eat my fish from. Their fish is really good.
Andrea grew up about 10 blocks away.
So this is an urban area, like I said, Hispanics and Blacks, everybody coexists.
You gave me hot sauce, ketchup, and tartar sauce?
The person working the counter is Sam Cho. He hands Andrea her shrimp combo.
Yeah, this place got the best fish.
Sam says the pandemic has scarred the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, it's been influencing everybody, you know? Like, there were more than, like, 5 to 8 fish markets in the hood. But then, right now, I think there's, like, only 2 or 3 survived after the COVID-19.
This fish market may have survived because it got a helping hand early on from the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP. That's the huge multi-billion-dollar federal program designed to help small businesses stay alive through COVID. It started last April.
Nearly $350 billion in loans will soon be available through lending partners to help small businesses meet payroll and other expenses for up to 2 months. These loans will be forgiven as long as businesses keep paying their workers. This includes sole proprietors and independent contractors.
Sole proprietors and independent contractors are the smallest of small businesses, and there are tens of millions of them in the United States. But much bigger businesses could get PPP money too. Companies with up to 500 employees or more in certain industries. With all the fear and uncertainty last April, everyone wanted some of this cash. Almost instantly.
Now to the latest with the coronavirus pandemic.
There wasn't enough.
Small businesses turning to the federal government for relief are out of luck. The loan program is out of money tonight.
Nearly $350 billion ran out in just 2 weeks. Congress replenished the pot, added many more billions, and eventually PPP loans went to millions of companies. Full disclosure, Reveal got some of that money too to help get through the pandemic. Now, Congress made it clear that this is not exactly a loan. It's forgivable, free money, if you follow the rules. But access to this money was not equal. Today, we're going to travel one LA Avenue, 10 miles, from a city neighborhood to the beach. Along the way, we'll see how businesses in Black and Latinx neighborhoods fared far worse than those in white neighborhoods when it came to getting PPP money. Reveal's Laura Morell investigates why they were left behind.
I'd like to introduce you to a barber.
My name is Daniel Sanchez, and I am an owner of the Gian's Barbershop, located on Manchester and Central.
We're about 10 miles east of the Pacific Ocean in LA's Florence neighborhood. It's majority Latinx, and Manchester Avenue is a main commercial strip. From the small homes with small yards off the side streets, there are plenty of shops to walk to. Daniel's barbershop sits between a furniture store and a used car lot. Because of COVID, the door to his shop is often gated shut now, but the outside wall has a mural that makes you feel like you're looking in. It shows two big red barber chairs and a man with a tidy trim. Daniel has wanted to run his own business since he was a kid.
I grew up always seeing my parents work hard, and they work hard for what they own. So it made me get motivated to have my own business and own it and run it, because you interact with the community, you see what's going on around you, and you get to meet new people.
Manchester is a big, busy street, and he used to get a lot of walk-in business. Not during COVID, though. Over this past year, Daniel has cut way back on hours and cut a lot less hair.
The haircuts were, like, not constantly coming in, and it was only by appointment. I only could have one person on the chair and one waiting for me, and that's about it.
Daniel's income went down, but like so many retail and service businesses that try to stay open, his cost to stay safe went up.
Once you walk in the shop, I had to put hand sanitizers. If a person walked in without a mask, I have to give them a mask and wear one for myself and my safety as well. I had to use capes so the hair won't get on the clients. I had to buy a whole bunch of them because I couldn't use one for every person.
Daniel did not get a PPP loan. According to government data, the car lot next to him did. So did a brake shop around the corner and a children's dentist a block away. But overall, small businesses in this neighborhood did not get help from the PPP pool of money.
Banks were allowed just to serve their existing customer base.
Jesse Van Toll heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which focuses on fair lending.
This was a government program. We wouldn't have said you can only get your stimulus check if you happen to have a banking relationship with a bank that's going to offer a stimulus check. But that's how the PPP program played out. And so what that meant was that the relief didn't reach everyone.
After that $350 billion disappeared so quickly, Congress started to investigate. A House subcommittee found that Treasury Department officials privately encouraged banks processing PPP loans to serve their current clients first. Some banks did that. Some even required PPP applicants to have a business checking account with them or a previous loan. The idea was to move money fast. But the subcommittee found that banks also knew this could exclude minority and women-owned businesses. An internal Citibank document spelled out that risk clearly. But the bank's executives decided only to help existing customers get PPP money. Jesse says the system was set up to fail minority-owned businesses.
You know, banks don't serve minority small businesses to the extent that they should. There should have been a mandate to lend to non-customers in addition to existing customers.
Daniel the barber didn't have a business banking relationship. He doesn't trust banks.
Sometimes when you go to a bank and you talk to some persons wouldn't want to help you because you're a barber. Don't put a lot of interest in it.
And he didn't want debt.
I don't like, you know, financial stuff and then you go and bankrupt. I don't want none of that.
So he never even applied for a PPP loan. Daniel never got the message that PPP loans are actually designed to be forgiven, so he wouldn't have had to pay it back. We used government data for a best estimate of the number of businesses in Daniel's neighborhood. Then we counted the number of PPP loans that landed there. Just 10% of businesses in this Latinx-majority area got PPP loans last year. How did other neighborhoods do? Let's head west.
Line 115. Welcome. Regular fare is 175.
The 115 bus runs the whole length of Manchester Avenue. For 5 miles, the bus passes chain restaurants, nail salons, small boutiques, and repair shops. Most buildings are one story, long and low, like so much of LA. Manchester runs through Inglewood. It's one of many small cities inside Metro LA. At Manchester and Crenshaw, there's a gas station on one corner and fast food restaurants on the other three.
Okay, so chili cheese dog and a Big Beaufort burger by itself. Anything else?
This neighborhood is mostly Black, but the area's gentrifying and increased rents put pressure on small businesses even before COVID. Last September, the long-planned SoFi Stadium opened in Inglewood.
Home to the LA Rams and LA Chargers, this revolutionary build cost over $5 billion, making it the most expensive sports ground in the world.
Not far from the stadium, local shops line Manchester.
And this one here is a barber and beauty shop. This shop is new. It's been here for maybe like 3 years now. It wasn't there before. The check cashing place has always been there, of course.
Annie Graham knows this stretch of Manchester like the back of her hand. She's giving my colleague David Rodriguez a tour.
This section from 5th across Manchester is all black-owned businesses here. So we all fighting to help each other to stay, you know, to stay in business, you know.
She stops in front of her own clothing store. There's a tree by the entrance, and in her windows you can see dresses on display.
The name's not up there, of course. I haven't put the name up there. I gotta get somebody to get the name. But it's called the White House by Miss Anne.
Did I say store? Miss Anne actually has 4. They're all in a row with connecting doors in between. The White House sells only white clothing, lace and ruffled dresses. Another shop has other fancy wear. And because people were staying home during COVID, she's now selling home decor in a third. And she sublets the last one. Miss Anne's has been on Manchester for 15 years.
I started out with just a little square in 2635, right? Just a square. And I kept working hard, and each time someone would move out, I would just go over, you know? So my plan is to go on down if anybody else move out, you know? That's my dream.
I spoke to Miss Anne several times over the past few months. On one phone call, she told me about how she built her business.
I came out here from Alabama when I graduated out of high school and went to college to be a school teacher, but I had a change of heart. I decided to start picking up items that I thought would be of value to sell, going around, actually digging in trash from the beginning, going to swap meets, going to Goodwill stores, going to garage sales, to create a business for myself, to have some kind of form of income. But I've never been employed by anybody since I came to California. I've always been my own boss.
She's had a lot of challenges, but nothing like COVID.
When we had to close, it's just like I went into a rage because I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It wasn't just like, oh, I got money stashed over here in a big old pile of money. And then they let us open back up again, but we could only do outside. And there's no way I could do curb selling with my dresses. People have to try things on. Women needs to try things on. You can't sell a woman a dress and say, oh, this will fit you. That'll look good on you. No, that is not how it goes.
She still has dresses she expected to sell for Easter and Mother's Day last year.
Actually, I hate to say this, but my main clients has only been for funerals. You know, so many people is dying now and people shopping for funeral dresses and for the person, you know, the deceased as well.
When COVID first shut down her shops, Miss Anne applied for a government loan that's been around for years. It's for small businesses during emergencies. She was turned down. The rejection letter said unsatisfactory credit. She looked into applying for a PPP loan through her bank, Wells Fargo. But the process was confusing, and she worried about getting another no. So she held off. Until Magic Johnson got involved.
Magic Johnson was offering business loans or grants for black-owned minority business women owners, right?
Here's how it worked. Starting last May, one of Magic's companies invested $100 million in a non-traditional lender called MBE Capital Partners. MBE used the money to make PPP loans until the government reimbursed them. Magic said on CNBC that he wanted to help small businesses that hadn't gotten access to PPP loans through traditional banks.
They probably didn't have a relationship with the banks when the stimulus package went out. So now we're able to say, hey, you can have a relationship with us. You can keep your employees, keep your doors open. And that's what we want to do, make sure that minority-owned firms, women-owned firms can stay open.
His words resonated with Miss Anne, so she applied for a PPP loan through MBE. She asked her friend Michael Childress to help with the application. He's an accountant.
So I helped her fill out the application, and we applied. We submitted, you know, all the paperwork that they requested, tax returns, so forth.
MBE wrote back asking for a specific form to prove Miss Anne had staff on payroll. She didn't have staff. 96% of black-owned businesses in the U.S. don't.
So we're not going to have that form. And they never mentioned that you would need that form when you apply. So we wrote them back and we was like, so is there any other information that we can submit to you to get her approved? And, you know, to no avail.
Many small businesses never get big enough to afford having staff. It's not the salary. It's paying for things like payroll taxes or just payroll processing. Before COVID, Miss Ann had about 6 people, mostly family, working for her as independent contractors. But because of shutdowns and slowdowns, she can't afford to pay them now. Here's the thing. Congress urged the Small Business Administration to write guidance for lenders to prioritize underserved communities. But the SBA failed to do that for 2.5 months.
Yeah, we were left behind. We were left behind. You know, it's as if they wanted us to lose our businesses or, you know, to struggle, you know, to make us give up.
Miss Ann is Black, but no one knows the race of each business owner who applied for PPP. That's because the SBA also initially failed to follow its own standard practice, asking for demographic information. So we looked at the addresses of businesses that got PPP loans. In LA and in big cities across the country, we found that majority white communities consistently benefited more than Latinx, Black, or Asian neighborhoods. In Ms. Ann's neighborhood, a law firm, a cafe, a laundromat, and a property management company got PPP loans last year. But overall, just over 30% of businesses here got help from the program. Just 1 in 3.
Please watch your step.
We keep going west on bus 115, all the way to the beach. It becomes more residential, and a bike lane creeps in before Manchester Avenue ends in Playa del Rey. It's a majority white neighborhood tucked between a nature preserve and the airport, with its own couple miles of beach.
Daddy, I think it might be big enough.
Think so?
Yeah.
You ready to get buried?
Yeah.
I love the community in Playa del Rey. It's a small town beach vibe, and it's just the best.
Joey Ancra runs an iconic burger joint a short stroll from the sand. It's got a patio out back and a huge sign with 2 palm trees. It looks like what it's called, The Shack.
The Shack has been here since 1972. Everybody knows The Shack. You can go anywhere. You can be in Australia and you have a Shack shirt on. They're like, I've been there. Everybody's been here. It's just been part of the staples of the community for a long, long time. And people love it. I love it.
In March, The Shack had to shut down because of COVID. In April, the staff posted this video on Facebook.
You're live now, Joey.
All of us at Shack love you. Somebody say something.
It was a little awkward and hard to hear them, but one fan wrote in the comments, "I hope you get one of those small business loans and survive." The Shack stayed closed, not even doing takeout, until finally in June.
Hey everybody, it's Joey at the Shack, and the Shack's back!
Until a month later, when an employee got sick.
Because yesterday at the Shack, it got real, real.
Closed down 2 weeks for quarantine, then open again.
I'm calling all friends, family, and customers this weekend to come out and support us. The struggle is real.
According to Small Business Administration data, The Shack got a $150,000 PPP loan last year. Joey doesn't do the books, so when we talked with him, he didn't know exactly what the money went to. But he knew it was real help right when his business needed it.
The PPP loans have really, they saved us. And of course, the community. My customers are the best customers in the world. They showed up. When I said I needed rent money, there would be a line around the block ordering Shack burgers. And I love them all for that.
Remember where we started, the east end of Manchester Avenue, in a majority Latinx neighborhood where 10% of all businesses got PPP loans. Then we followed the road through majority Black neighborhoods where about 30% of businesses got them. At the western end of Manchester, in white majority Playa del Rey, about 60% of businesses got loans from the Paycheck Protection Program last year. 60%. Twice as high as near Miss Ann and 6 times higher than Daniel's neighborhood. All 3 communities are in LA. They're just 10 miles apart along the same street. But travel that street and you travel the distance between decent access to PPP help and close to none at all. This year, The Shack applied for and received a second PPP check. Joey's still doing videos.
Hey, everybody, it's Joey at The Shack. Get your vaccine. so we can get our party back on. Love you!
And back in Inglewood, we tried to figure out whether there was any way Magic Johnson's partner, MBE Capital, could help Miss Ann get a PPP loan, even though she didn't have staff. A few weeks ago, MBE's president, Cara Wallace, agreed to talk with me. She said MBE should have followed up with Miss Ann last year.
I would love to tell you that we gave excellent customer service to everybody, you know, all 20,000 people. We're a small business that are minority-owned business ourselves, but in this world of PPP, yeah, we weren't the best.
Still, MBE made PPP loans in majority Black areas at three times the rate they did in majority white neighborhoods. And after Cara talked to me, she called Ms. Ann. By then, Ms. Ann had decided to try again. She reapplied with a new lender under new PPP rules this year. And help finally came through. Months after she first tried to get PPP assistance, she received almost $15,000.
Thanks to Reveal's Laura Morell for bringing us that story. In Los Angeles alone, the disparities we found in PPP lending translate to potentially 79,000 businesses in Asian, Black, and Latinx neighborhoods missing out on emergency aid. Beyond Los Angeles, the disparities persist. Check out our interactive map at revealnews.org to see how your city did. In 4 out of 5 major U.S. metros, majority white neighborhoods got more loans per business last year compared to neighborhoods with Black, Latinx, or Asian majorities.
I mean, I have to say, I'm not surprised. It makes me extremely upset, but I'm not surprised.
One fair lending activist wants to change the way banks do business. That's next on Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, sitting in for Al Letson. Traveling Manchester Avenue through Los Angeles just now, we heard how the Paycheck Protection Program left communities of color behind.
From the onset, it was designed to fail a segment of the population. It was designed to run through banks.
Paulina Gonzalez Brito is executive director of the California Reinvestment Coalition, a bank watchdog group. Paulina says the PPP program is another example of banks excluding communities of color. Banks say they were responding to an unprecedented emergency with PPP.
Bank of America was one of the first major banks, the first major bank to begin accepting applications. We reassigned 10,000 employees to work on the program and provided 250,000 loans in the first month of the program.
So what went wrong? Reveal's Emily Harris reports.
Here's Paulina Gonzalez-Brito's short history of banks when it comes to communities of color.
Banks have historically not served our communities, and we've seen it throughout, through redlining and through the subprime mortgage crisis. You know, we've seen that it has failed our communities time and time again.
Redlining dates back to the 1930s, when banks used maps drawn by federal agencies to deny home loans in mainly Black neighborhoods. The practice lasted for decades and to some degree continues today. In the subprime mortgage crisis, lenders did the reverse, offering easy loans on predatory terms. Black and Latinx people in particular lost their homes during that crisis.
So when you have a crisis like COVID, like a pandemic, when you say, okay, we're going to put together a recovery program, and you run that recovery program through that same system, you're going to see the same result, right? You're not going to see an equitable recovery.
The Community Reinvestment Act was supposed to address inequity in lending when it was passed more than 40 years ago. It says banks must meet the credit needs of people in all communities they serve, as long as that doesn't go against sound banking practices.
Not just to people who happen to, say, be the wealthiest or have the strongest relationship, but to all consumers in that assessment area.
Julie Stackhouse was a Federal Reserve vice president until retiring last year. She oversaw the regulators who are supposed to make sure banks are following that law.
You have an obligation, an affirmative obligation, to make loans as well as take deposits. But it's not quantified as to what that is. So that's where the regulatory process comes into play.
There's a mix of ways that banks can meet what regulators are looking for. Advertise loans, make loans, give grants to community groups. Bank regulators have already decided that most PPP loans will count too.
I understand we have about a half an hour, is that right? Is there any leeway on that?
Yes.
I got on Zoom with Dan Latendra, a senior vice president at Bank of America. The bank was the biggest PPP lender in 2020, by far. It processed about 340,000 loans, roughly 50,000 more than anybody else. Dan heads a team at Bank of America
with the sole mission of finding creative ways to increase access to capital in low-income and minority communities.
Dan told me that when the pandemic shut down businesses, the bank jumped in to help. Employees worked in shifts around the clock. I told him what we'd found. In cities including Los Angeles, New York, Dallas, and Miami, Bank of America's PPP loans went to businesses in majority white communities about twice as often as in majority Black or Latinx communities.
Is this outcome okay to you?
So even before the emergency program began, we did recognize that the Paycheck Protection Program design would present challenges for many of our clients, and in particular, for very small businesses.
The vast majority of Black and Latinx-owned businesses are very small. Dan says Bank of America saw fewer applications for PPP loans from communities of color. He blames the Treasury Department and the Small Business Administration for how they wrote the rules.
When I go back to those frenetic days, the view was, how does the economy or system get money to employees who can't go to work and are therefore likely to be unemployed, which I think was valuable and important. I think that the unintended consequence was that the funding went to businesses that had employees and didn't go as much to businesses that don't have employees. And it is true that the smaller businesses that don't have employees were more frequently present in minority communities and low-income communities. So they did see less money.
And I guess the question is, why is that still okay? Because across the board, everybody was facing the same uncertainty, the same dark days. Why is it okay to still leave out more businesses in Black and Latinx communities than in white communities in 2020?
We didn't design the program. I know the intentions of the program in its design were to assist employees.
The law that created PPP, though, specifically said self-employed people were eligible for PPP loans. The Small Business Administration declined an interview. A spokesperson said in an email that the new administration has made changes to ensure equitable distribution of PPP relief. So what does it mean for a small business to be left out of PPP? Cheryl Fears is the business manager of the Crucial Kids Dance Company in Los Angeles.
I'm 72. I mean, I'm good. I'm just helping my granddaughter.
Her granddaughter owns the studio. Cheryl says she couldn't get a PPP loan for Crucial Kids when she applied last year through Bank of America, where she keeps the company accounts. She wound up getting a different kind of emergency loan from the government, $21,000, that she says went straight to past due rent. But unlike a PPP loan, this is not forgivable. She has to pay it back with interest.
First of all, $21,000, they're giving me 30 years to pay it back. I'll be dead and gone if my granddaughter still be paying this loan back.
JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo were also among the biggest PPP lenders nationally. Combined, they processed more than $39 billion worth of loans last year. And in major cities across the country, their loans went to businesses in majority white communities, persistently more often than in Black and Latinx communities. Those banks wouldn't agree to taped interviews, but a Wells Fargo spokesman told me the government paid the bank $420 million in fees for PPP lending last year, and that all that money is going to a fund to help small businesses. Chase won't say how much it earned in fees, but says the costs ate up any profits. And Dan at Bank of America said his bank gave cash and access to capital to help community-based lenders make PPP loans.
Those loans don't show up in Bank of America's numbers. Those would be in the CDFI numbers.
CDFI stands for Community Development Financial Institution. And nearly a quarter of them did make over half their PPP loans in communities of color. But their impact was so small that the program disparities overall stay the same. In the vast majority of cities with more than a million people, the rate of PPP lending in majority white communities was consistently higher than in Black, Latinx, or Asian communities. Right now, the Community Reinvestment Act says regulators have to grade banks on how well they meet the credit needs of low and moderate income areas. The Federal Reserve is asking how to change the rules to address systemic inequity specifically affecting communities of color. Stella Adams, a Black business owner and a longtime advocate of equitable lending, says it's high time.
You can't say that the inequities in lending are the responsibility initially of anyone but the federal government. And so when you are explicitly responsible for racial inequities, then you need to explicitly take responsibility and utilize your regulatory authority under the Community Reinvestment Act to address it.
Paulina Gonzalez Brito, head of the California Reinvestment Coalition, hopes there's momentum now.
I think, to be honest, what is happening is a real reckoning around race in this country. You know, the murder of George Floyd made us all really look at the ways in which white supremacy and systems are complicit. And the financial system has to be one of those systems that we look at. It has to be policy changes and systems changes if we're actually going to make a difference in the way that they've been functioning for generations.
Reveal's Emily Harris brought us that story. It wasn't just traditional banks that got involved in PPP loans. Online lenders jumped in too. But community lenders were largely shut out at the beginning for a variety of reasons. Then, last May, 2 months after the program started, the Trump administration set aside $10 billion of PPP money for community development financial institutions. But money is not the only ingredient. Reveal's Laura Morrell followed along with a loan officer at one of these financial institutions in Arizona to see what it takes to reach businesses that large banks leave behind.
Just record. There we go. We're recording. So just to start off, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Mark McKenna, and I'm a business development officer for Préstamos CDFI.
Préstamos CDFI is your partner in economic development, small business growth, and quality job creation. Our loan products and consulting services are designed...
Préstamos means we lend in Spanish, and that's what Mark does. He helps small businesses get access to capital.
I work in the Southern Arizona community, and I support that part of Arizona.
When I Zoom with Mark, he's usually wearing a baseball cap.
So this is the local University of Arizona. This is the Wildcats.
Okay.
And if you live in Tucson, you're a Wildcat fan.
Mark's a Tucson guy, born and raised there. He's of Irish and Mexican descent, and although his parents spoke Spanish, he's not completely fluent.
I understood Spanish, but I just never had conversational Spanish growing up. But along the years and speaking with people, you know, I've kind of honed my skills, especially like in banking terminology and lending terminology. So you learn those words, and I can roll my R, so...
And that helps Mark and his team reach out to clients in Latinx communities in the Southwest. Préstamos' outreach seemed to make a difference last year. In Tucson and Phoenix, about 10% of loans overall went to businesses in majority Latinx communities. About 25% of Prestamo's loans did.
Shira, is Ebony available?
For the past year, Mark's been set up with three computer screens in his bedroom, working the phones day and night.
Yeah, I let her know Mark McKenna called from Prestamos.
He's racing to get applications in before the deadline.
Yeah, because we're all working towards that cutoff point. But there's going to be a day where on this day, if the app's not in, it's not getting looked at.
We've heard that when the government rushed out the first round of PPP last year, the big banks were encouraged to make loans to their existing customers. That meant a lot of smaller businesses that didn't have relationships with the bank missed out. And it disproportionately harmed business owners in majority Black and Latinx communities.
You know, you hear, wow, I applied there, but, you know, we didn't have any luck.
Just like Daniel the barber in L.A., many small business owners in Tucson and across the country didn't even bother applying in the first rounds, especially the smallest of businesses, the sole proprietors. And there are nearly 25 million of them in the United States. They're landscapers, daycare owners, accountants, fitness instructors. Mark says he's connected with many sole proprietors who figured they didn't qualify because they didn't have employees. But it turns out they did qualify. He tells me about a business owner he reached out to in the third round of PPP that started in January, and he was able to help her get a small loan, about $975.
But she's happy. You know, she's like, man, I'm so glad, you know, you helped me out with this. And she's grateful for it.
Going over her tax return, he noticed something.
I'm seeing, you know, that her husband, he's a taxi driver. He also filed a Schedule C.
That's a tax form that sole proprietors and independent contractors use.
Hey, I said, you got to get your husband to apply too. Let's get him. He has that money available to him. And she's like, are you kidding me? Oh my God, you don't know what this is going to do for us right now. Those are the stories that keep me working to midnight.
Mark has cold called a trucking company trying to persuade management to get their independent drivers to contact him. He Zooms with business groups, and he tells everyone he knows to tell somebody they know to call him if they run their own business and could use a hand surviving the pandemic.
Even my barber. I'm like, Miguel, dude, you didn't apply last year. I'm telling him. I said, you know what? I'm going to tell you right now. You better give me your stuff so you can benefit, you know. So he did. And he got like a little over $3,000.
These amounts seem tiny when you consider the average PPP loan is about $100,000. But for some small businesses, it can mean the difference in paying the rent or the electric bill. Finding people who didn't apply is one challenge. Another, Mark says some of his clients don't have their financial documents in order or just can't get them to him.
I would tell people, yes, scan your documents for me and send them to me by email. Here's my, you know, they don't have a scanner at home. Or much less a computer.
So Mark gets creative. He tells them to take a photo of their ID and bank statements and send them to him. Just like the banks, CDFIs make a commission on PPP. Prestamos made about 900 loans totaling some $26 million last year. It's not a huge number.
We're not going to do the volume per se, but we're definitely going to add value to the process. And I don't know how many times people will say, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I'm talking to somebody. So I'm like, yeah, you're talking to somebody.
Nationwide, CDFIs processed only 13% of the PPP loans last year. They don't have the resources of big banks. When I asked Mark what banks could be doing to reach more communities of color, he says it's pretty simple. They need to build relationships in those communities.
But it takes a lot of time and probably a little bit more money.
I started calling Mark in February. That was near the beginning of the third round of PPP, which started in the last days of the Trump administration. About a week after our first conversation,
I just had an opportunity to catch up with two small business owners I met.
President Biden announced changes to the PPP program to make it easier for small business owners.
On Wednesday, the Small Business Administration is going to establish a 14-day exclusive PPP loan application period for businesses and nonprofits with fewer than 20 employees.
And there was a key revision for the smallest business owners, the sole proprietors. They could now qualify based on their gross income. Before, it was based on net income, what they took home after taxes and expenses.
Ron, how are you? This is Mark McKenna with Presamos.
What that boils down to is more of Mark's clients are qualifying, and some are getting more money.
So based off of your Schedule C,
they'll also have a little more time to apply. The Small Business Administration is now accepting PPP applications until the end of May.
Thanks to Reveal's Laura Morell. Mark McKenna is busy helping tiny businesses get emergency help to make it through the pandemic. Plenty of big businesses got PPP help too. But what happens when companies get government money to protect workers and they don't do it? You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. The restaurant industry was one of the hardest hit by the pandemic. When stay-at-home orders spread throughout the country last year, about 180,000 of them abruptly shut their doors. PPP loans were supposed to help restaurant workers keep their jobs, but also keep them safe. Owners who got PPP money had to agree to follow workplace safety requirements set by OSHA, the federal agency in charge of worker safety and health. More than $1 billion went to fast food franchises like Wendy's, Pizza Hut, and McDonald's. So did companies that got PPP money follow through on their promises to keep people safe? Freelance journalist Gabriel Thompson and Reveal's Lance Williams investigated McDonald's, where more than 2,000 franchises got PPP money. And Gabriel joins me now. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, you looked at what happened at one particular McDonald's that is owned by someone who owns several McDonald's.
Yeah, this is one of these larger franchisees who operates 15 McDonald's, mostly in the Chicago area. The owner there received more than $500,000 in PPP money. And one of the stores that she operates is a big brick building on Chicago's southwest side. I got to know two women who worked there, Adriana Sanchez and Kenya Campiando. And, you know, Kenya went on maternity leave in the early days of the pandemic. But when she came back last summer, she was amazed that with the pandemic in full swing, the McDonald's looked pretty much the way it did before.
Hubo muchísima demanda de trabajo. Entonces, por la demanda de trabajo, no podíamos tener el distanciamiento.
So she's saying here that the store was simply so busy with orders and that they needed a lot of workers and those workers simply couldn't be, you know, socially distanced. Both Kenya and Adriana told me that it wasn't uncommon to have four or five people all on top of each other, especially near the drive-through window. And they said they would run out of basic supplies like hand sanitizer and gloves and soap. So at times they were washing cooking dishes with just water. And that masks were a problem. You know, that they said the company had a supply of disposable masks, but that when they asked for them, they were told that those masks were for customers who entered, not for the workers themselves.
Was there something they could do about this? Did they talk to their bosses?
Yeah, Adriana did. And she describes response always being sort of like nothing. And so that's why in July, she actually filed a complaint with OSHA. And in that complaint, she alleges that McDonald's was not providing workers with proper masks at the job.
Did OSHA do anything about these complaints?
Yeah, OSHA sent a letter to Adriana's employer and corresponded with them, but then closed the case without doing an actual inspection of the McDonald's or even speaking directly with Adriana.
What is the inspection part supposed to result in? Does it result in fees, fines? Like, why does the inspection part matter?
You know, a company can have all sorts of great proposals or procedures on paper, but if you're not out there inspecting, I think you're really allowing employers to police themselves. And OSHA obviously can't inspect every complaint, but we found that during COVID, you know, they really took the path of inspecting almost no one. And that was very common. That's according to David Michaels. He's the former head of OSHA under Obama. He also told me it didn't have to be this way. He said during that 2008-2009 recession, the government gave billions of dollars to employers to keep folks working. And they also gave OSHA money for inspections. And that's really what didn't happen here.
Are there any consequences for restaurants that received PPP money but also faced just like a ton of complaints about COVID and safety?
In a word, no. I mean, you could be a business that gets PPP funds that racks up a long list of worker complaints around COVID safety, or that has multiple outbreaks of COVID-19. But there's nothing that states in those loans that if you do that, your loan won't be forgivable. From March through December of last year, fast food workers filed more than 1,600 coronavirus-related complaints to OSHA. And more than 80 of those complaints were at fast food restaurants with owners who had received PPP money. And one of the perennial complaints, again, is the lack of masks for workers on the job. In fact, at a McDonald's in Oakland, workers complained that a manager suggested they actually wear dog diapers for masks on their faces. Apparently, a customer had left a box of dog diapers at the store. And that was its suggestion for how they could protect themselves from COVID-19 was to actually place these dog diapers on their faces.
Well, I mean, I get improvising, but dog diapers doesn't feel like the right move there. All right. So several months have passed since Kenya and Adriana's first OSHA complaints in the summer. Have things changed at their restaurant since then?
According to them, not all that much. You know, this past October, they said soap was still running out. They're still running out of supplies like hand sanitizer and gloves and masks. It was still super crowded at the drive-through window. And then one day, Kenya arrived at work and she noticed that there was a long line of cars, longer than normal in the drive-through lane. And everything seemed backed up. And a lot of her coworkers simply weren't there. And folks are wondering what's going on. And then she hears the manager say that a bunch of people had called in sick. So Kenya goes home after that shift and she gets tested for COVID and she tests positive. And eventually her whole family will get sick. You know, her husband, her three kids, including her baby. And that was enough for Adriana. When she learned that her friend Kenya was positive, they both decided that they finally needed to take more action.
Entonces, entre ella y yo, pues dijimos no. O sea, si no hacemos algo, ¿quién lo va a hacer?
So here she's saying, you know, no, this is enough. They both decide right then to go on strike, and it's just the two of them. They're supported by the Fight for 15. That's this campaign to organize and protect fast food workers that's run by the Service Employees International Union. They're the ones who put me in touch with Kenya and Adriana. And along with going on strike, they file two new OSHA complaints. Again, these complaints are about lack of masks, lack of social distancing. But they also point out that they've learned six workers at the restaurant have tested positive for COVID-19. And then in addition, two floating workers, the ones who would move from store to store and work at their own store, had died from COVID-19. After a couple of weeks, the women both returned to work. But then a week after returning to work, Adriana then contracts COVID, and she has to stay home more than 2 weeks to recuperate.
Now, just as a reminder, the point of PPP loans is to continue to pay workers even if they have to stay home. So did Adriana or Kenya or any of the other McDonald's workers who got sick, did they get paid to stay home?
Adriana told me that for nearly 3 weeks she was out, she only received 14 hours of paid sick time. So that's roughly 2 days worth. And Kenya, who missed about the same amount of time, said she only received 8 hours. Later, Kenya's manager gave her an additional week's pay and told her that was because she was a good worker.
What did the owner say about all of this?
I reached her by phone. She declined to speak with me. However, later, through a spokesperson with McDonald's USA, she did send a statement that, you know, masks were available to workers beginning in late April of 2020, and that there had never been a break in supplies for gloves, soap, or masks at the stores. She also said that she has a policy of offering paid sick leave to those impacted by COVID-19. Again, that contradicted what Kenya and Adriana described to me. I also hope to have an interview with McDonald's corporate office representatives. They didn't agree to an interview, but they did send me a statement in which they noted that they had, quote, enhanced over 50 operational and safety processes in restaurants, including requiring masks, gloves, and daily wellness checks. But again, the descriptions from Adriana and Kenya really paint quite a different picture.
All right, Gabriel, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
That was freelance journalist Gabriel Thompson. There have been three rounds of PPP loans. None of them included worker protections. Under President Biden, OSHA has started an initiative to increase inspections of workplaces for COVID-19 hazards. Genya and Adriana's store was inspected in January, but OSHA found no violations. By the time of the inspection, the restaurant had put in place plexiglass dividers and other worker protections. This story featured additional reporting from Lance Williams. It was produced by Amy Mostafa. If you want to hear more stories about money and the economy, you should check out my podcast. It's called Planet Money from NPR. Reveal's Mohammed Al-Alou did the data analysis for today's show. Our lead producer this week is Emily Harris. She had help from David Rodriguez, Stan Alcorn, and Avishai Artsy. Jennifer Gorin and Taki Telenidis edited today's show. Sue Oh is our data editor. Esther Kaplan edited the digital version of this story, which you can find at revealnews.org. Special thanks to Aaron Glantz and Sarah Cohen. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mostafa. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Aruda. They had help this week from Brett Simpson and Amita Ganatra. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Subi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Inasmuch Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.